Welcome everyone again to Friday night. Those of you who are new, we have these talks every Friday from 7 to 9. It's a 20-minute guided meditation, a talk, Q&A, break. If you have any questions, you're welcome to ask them at the end. If you ever have any questions of me, so my name's Nalushi, I'm one of the volunteers who help organise these events. Come and find me at any time. Always a real privilege to have, you know, have us come together to have this time for spirituality and reflection and meditation. I always feel very honored that I can be part of this and we can do this together. I just acknowledge the Indigenous custodians of the lands that we're meeting on, the Cammeraygal people, and pay my respect to their elders. And know that it's NAIDOC week, I think, isn't it? Or next week or something?
What's NAIDOC week? To explain for our folks on that.
National, help me out here, Indigenous
Day of Celebration.
Say again?
National Aboriginal Day of Celebration.
Okay, there we are. National Aboriginal. It's a very famous annual celebration of the Indigenous people.
What? Obviously not that famous.
I know the acronym.
It's next week.
Next week. Well, there's always lots of events in Sydney, so we can line up, I guess. The toilets are just past the elevators to your left. And also, feel free to take a flyer of these events if you want to tell your friends about it. And there's also a flyer for our Sutta Print project, which is basically Bhante Sujato's translations of the early Buddhist teachings. There's a project to print out copies for local institutions and temples and things. So if you want to either donate to that or get a copy for yourself, it's like a bulk printing at a cheaper price, $350. So for a set of 28 books, it's quite a good deal. So there's some information about that. And there's a newbies guide as well. So if you're new to these talks, feel free to grab one of those. Finally, I'll just introduce our speaker, Bhante Sujato. He's been a Buddhist monastic for 30 years, or around 30 years. We're very privileged to have such a senior speaker. He was the abbot of Santi Monastery for about 10 years. He started training in Thailand and then later with Ajahn Brahm in Perth. And he spent a couple of years translating the early Buddhist teachings into modern to contemporary English in free sort of without, like, copies without copyright. I'd best to say that. and you can look up suttacentral.net to find the online versions and just suttas in many different languages. It's a really good resource. And he's done countless workshops and retreats and talks over the years, and a lot of advocacy as well for environmental issues and rights of female monastics in particular, which is pretty amazing. And lots of interfaith events as well, so important in our times. So we're really lucky to have such an extraordinary speaker and monastic bless us tonight. So thank you, Bhante. Thank you all. Have a wonderful evening.
Thank you, Nalushi. Right. So how's everyone doing tonight? Everyone doing okay? I don't know if you did. Anybody notice there were zebras spotted outside? Did anyone notice that? It's so weird, right? Normally they're striped. I'm sorry, okay? I'm sorry, all right? Okay, blame my teeth. Blame Ajahn Brahm. It's all Ajahn Brahm's. It's all we could... The lights at the front here? Yeah, if we could keep just these lights up here, it would be good, the indirect ones. Good. Keep going. Is that a good?
Yeah.
Keep going? No? Yes? Good. We're good, Nalushi. We're good. Okay. Excellent. All right. Let's begin with some chanting. If you need chanting sheets, should be handed around. If anyone needs, do you need a chanting sheet? Please, chanting sheets. Oh, phones too. Phones, please, turn them off. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato Buddhaṃ saraṇaṃ gacchāmi. Iti piso bhagavā sambuddho vidha sugato loka vidu anuttaro purisa dhamma sati sadhade sambuddho Swakato bhagavata sambhiko anandiko ehipatiko anayiko patatamvedako vinyuhiti supatipanno bhagavato sāvaka-sāngho ujjupatipanno bhagavato sāvaka-sāngho nyāyapatipanno bhagavato sāvaka-sāngho samīcipatipanno bhagavato sāvaka-sāngho Iyavidam chattari purisa yuga bi akha purisa pungala esa bhagavato savaka sangho ahuneyo dhantineyo anjali karmiyo anuttara Punya Keta Kasati. You were chatting outside? Oh, I don't know. Well, that's very kind of you. Thank you. Okay, so so I'd like to talk for a few minutes about mindfulness of breathing meditation, and we can do some meditation together. So, when it comes to meditation, I think perhaps we live in a world where more people are meditating than ever before. I don't know if that's really true, but it seems to me like that's the case. And meditation's become kind of normalized across world culture in ways that it really hasn't been in the past. And often comes as a surprise to people to know that, like in most forms of traditional Buddhism, that meditation isn't really a kind of a normal practice. I mean, do people know that? Some people do, some people don't. I mean, meditation has always been there. People have been doing some meditation, but normally most traditional Buddhism is more devotional rather than contemplative or meditative. And often we think, therefore, because we're doing meditation, therefore that means that we're better. Is that right? That we're better than them. Is that right? No?
Get angry.
You meditate and you get angry?
I expect it to be better.
They expect you to be better. Like if you meditate, then you're not supposed to get angry or anything like that. Yeah. You're supposed to be an angel if you meditate. Nice. Excellent. So often there's this kind of attitude, or at least I kind of feels to me like there's this kind of attitude, right? So if you like meditation is like real Buddhism, right? Whereas if you're like doing devotions and offering flowers at the shrine and things like that, that's cultural Buddhism. Is that right? I don't know. It feels a bit racist to me.
Oh, how about more like sectist?
The what, sorry?
Sectist, because race would imply that it's different ethnic group, but it's more like...
Oh, it is.
So sectist, so it's like a different sect or sort of thing.
Yeah, no, but it's...
Maybe another practice.
No, but it is. That's the point.
Okay.
Yeah, so the normalization of meditation, not entirely, but it's often configured as being a kind of a Western thing.
Oh, okay, I didn't.
Yeah, whereas in, and then okay. Cultural Buddhism, because, of course, in English-speaking culture, the important thing to understand is that in English-speaking countries, we don't have a culture, right? It's just like the norm. And other things are ethnic, okay? That's how that kind of works. Anyway, so... And look, it's not a perspective that I entirely disagree with, right? I do think, in fact, meditation is a crucial part of Buddhist practice, and I wish more traditional Buddhists would do meditation. However, at the same time, if you listen to traditional Buddhists and what they say about meditation, some of them will say, oh, meditation drives you crazy, right? Again, they're not entirely wrong. I mean... If you sat around with a bunch of Buddhist psychologists and talked about meditation, most of them will say that they've gone crazy at some point in time, or that they know people who have, or whatever, or you have these wild experiences. But my point is not to really talk about that. My point is to say that the difference between what we passed down as traditional Buddhism and what we're practicing today, that I think that there is a difference, and it's wrong to say that there isn't a difference, but it's also to say that I think each different way of practicing Buddhism has its own wisdom, and that there's something that can be learned from these things. So when practicing, let's say, a conventional or traditional Buddhism, maybe emphasizing devotional practices, okay? So what does that do? Well, that elevates your heart. That creates like a softness and a gentleness in the way that you hold yourself within a religious or spiritual environment. And if you go to, let's say, something like Kelaniya in Sri Lanka near Colombo, and you see the people wandering from one, from the Bodhi tree to the stupa to the different sacred sites, there's a humility and a simplicity and a gentleness and a beauty that they bring to that sacred environment that expresses their Dhamma in that particular way. And so through these traditional forms of religious practice, there is actually something which is uplifting and meaningful. Right? It's not separated from Buddhist practice or from how we do things. And that those qualities of humility and simplicity and devotion and gentleness are, I think, intrinsic to our undertaking of meditation itself. Another important dimension is the dimension of sila, keeping precepts. Again, if you go to traditional Buddhist countries, certainly Theravada Buddhist countries, then standard thing that you do all the time is you take the five precepts. Right? So you do this at every ceremony and so on. And I just want to say for the record that when we do the chanting here, we don't regularly take the five precepts, okay? And there's no particular reason for that except my understanding is that if you want to take the five precepts, you should ask for it. So if you want to take the five precepts at these events, just ask and we're happy to do that, okay? But it's not my job to tell you that you should be taking the five precepts. So that's why we don't do it here, okay? But if you want to, just ask, okay? So, but taking five precepts, of course, is the foundation, the behavioral foundation for meditation. And in cultures where they, without naming them, American Buddhist cultures, without naming those particular kinds of cultures that say, oh, we don't need to do all of those cultural practice, you're also saying you find that along with that, like we did a retreat with one group and there was like a particular kind of non-sectarian or new Buddhist group. And you know, we did a retreat in their center one time, and in the cupboard was a fairly decent selection of different wines that they were obviously consuming on their retreats. Right, so we can see that. So you can see that when you start sort of stepping down this road, then you're not just saying, "Oh, yes, meditation is somehow better," but also becomes an excuse to not do things like keeping your precepts and various other things like that. So all I'm really trying to say here is that when we do meditation, that our meditation practice emerges within the life that we've chosen to lead for ourselves, and that the way we do those things impacts our meditation. And the ways that Buddhist communities have learned to do Buddhism over hundreds and thousands of years has something to teach us. And it's not to say that we're going to do things exactly the same way. Obviously, we're not. But there are things that we can learn about how we can uplift ourselves to practice the Dhamma in a way that is meaningful. When meditation is grounded on devotion and humility and gentleness, and when it's grounded on precepts and it's grounded on like how we live our life and living our life to be a good person, then meditation starts to be something which is much more flourishing, much more abundant. It's not just a patch that we apply to our life to fix things up so we can keep on creaking along with the same machinery that we had before. Right? Meditation should be something that's organic. It grows in and with and through our lives, so that our life becomes our meditation and our meditation becomes our life, and they're mutually reinforcing, mutually flourishing. So when we come to meditate, when we actually do the act of meditating, none of that is real. Everything I just mentioned doesn't exist, okay? There's no such thing as the Buddha. There's no such thing as Buddhism. There's no such thing as Dhamma. There's no such thing as your life. There's no such thing as history. There's no such thing as culture. None of those things are real. The only thing that's real is your breath, okay? None of those things are there. I mean, ideally, okay? All right? So we come down to something which is very, very hyper-specific. Only breath. Yeah? That's it. Everything else is gone, and yet somehow everything else is still present because everything is somehow present in that breath. And that breath somehow contains within it the wisdom and the peace and the joy and the humility and all of those things that have made up our life somehow inform our meditation and create the flow of our meditation. That's why if you're a bad person, you come along to do meditation, it's not going to work. Or maybe it does work. If it does work, it's even worse. If you're a bad person, you come and do meditation and it works, then you're in real trouble. Because then you'd be like, oh, it's good that I'm a bad person because now my meditation's good and so now I can even be better at being a bad person. That's excellent, right? So that can happen, right, in a limited way. It'll fall apart eventually. So but if we can ground our Dhamma practice on our lives, ground our Dhamma practice on every breath, on every thought, on every act, every intention that we do, and so that our meditation is something which comes from that and emerges from that rather than being something that we impose like a Band-Aid to fix the problems that we've made with our lives. This is really the point that I'm trying to get at. Meditation should be organic. Meditation, when we're developing our mind, it's the same mind. It's the mind that we had yesterday. It's the mind that we had when we were kids. I mean, it's evolving and changing all the time. It's the same stream of consciousness. The meditation mind is not something that's separate from the mind outside of meditation. And so we bring into that meditation everything that we've learned from our lives, and we bring from the meditation everything we learn from that into our lives again. So each of those things reinforce each other. If we're thinking of our life and our meditation as being opposed to each other, then we haven't learned to integrate those two things. We need to reflect and we need to learn so that our meditation and our lives are integrated and supporting each other. Okay, let's do some meditation. Forget everything I just said. So sitting quietly. Letting the mind settle back into your body. Mindfully breathing in, mindfully breathing out. 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 Feeling the breath soothe you. Feeling the breath calm you. Letting the breath bring a certain softness, a certain delicacy to all the different parts of your body. So now coming near to the end of the meditation. Before we finish, reflecting back, asking ourselves, what happened during that meditation? How did my mind change? What was my mood at the start of the meditation? How did that shift? What's my mood like now? And finally, we can dedicate the merit of our practice. May all beings be well. May all beings be safe. May all beings be happy and free. Okay. Let's have a break, stretch your legs, grab a cup of tea. Back for some Dhamma talk. All right, so I don't know if anybody has any better ideas, but I did have a thought for what I wanted to talk about this evening. Does anyone have any better ideas? No. If you have an idea, it's probably better.
Nirvana.
Nirvana. A message from one of the Buddha's lives. Okay. Both of those are good ideas. Anyone else? Empty of ideas. Nilushi, how do you relate to uncertainty? Okay, so these are all ideas. So far we've got Nibbana, we've got one of the Buddha's past lives, we've got how to relate to uncertainty. So that the idea that I had, which is not much of an idea, but a few years ago, I wrote really just kind of a blog post, but it was like a checklist of the differences between Theravada and early Buddhism. And that's become kind of a bit popular, like it's been translated. Sabbamitta, I don't know if she's around here today. Sabbamitta is translated into German. So all of our German folks can read it in German, but of course if you're here, you can speak English anyway. So and they also, I think they translated it into Indonesian as well. So obviously some people found it of interest. I don't know if that would be of interest. Yes. I could talk about it. Would that be something?
Yeah.
Is that better or worse than those other ideas? It's different, I guess. It's different. I could, yeah, but that would be showing off. I could. All right, so first of all, the differences between Theravada and Buddhism, between Theravada and early Buddhism are uncertain. But they lead to Nibbana. You see? And so there you go, that's how that works. Let me see. Okay. All right. So for those who are interested, this is on our Discourse forum, and you can get it as a few different formats, PDF. You can order it as a book if you want. So it's a bit too long. Like, I won't be able to talk about all the different things here, but let me just give you a little bit of a brief background. So what do we mean when we're talking about Theravada? What do we mean when we're talking about early Buddhism? Very briefly, when we talk about early Buddhism, we're talking about the Buddhism that the Buddha taught, or that we have scriptures for the Buddha taught, obviously in the Pali Canon and in parallels for those scriptures. And the study of those teachings and practices is the study of early Buddhism. Now, these days, it's become quite fashionable to talk about like early Buddhism as if it's almost like a school of Buddhism. So you're like, oh, I'm an early Buddhism practitioner. People like label their Dhamma centers and things like that as early Buddhism. So I don't really do that. I don't know. I've been teaching this for a while now. I've been teaching Buddhism for a while, and I've lived long enough to see a number of things that I've talked about become like schools of Buddhism and so on. And I'm like, yeah, this is not why we talked about this thing. So we're not talking about early Buddhism so we can make a new school of Buddhism that's going to be early Buddhism. And in fact, I don't teach or practice early Buddhism, just so you're clear. I teach or practice the very latest Buddhism that has ever existed, which is the Buddhism that's happening right now. However, I do believe that it's important to be informed by what the Buddha taught, and that that is a guide to what we're doing. So the study of early Buddhism is based on a historical study of what did the Buddha actually teach. But I won't go into all of those sort of text historical details right now. So Theravada Buddhism is a school of Buddhism which currently prevails in mostly Sri Lanka, Myanmar, Thailand, Cambodia, Laos, partly in Vietnam and Bangladesh, also in India, as well as, of course, spread around the world, largely missionized by those places. So Theravada Buddhism is a school of Buddhism that takes the Pali canon as its scripture, and that Pali canon is the most reliable record that we have for early Buddhist teachings. Again, without going into all of the details as to why that is so. So Theravada Buddhism these days is usually contrasted with Mahayana Buddhism. And so Mahayana Buddhism is based on scriptures which were developed somewhat later, about 500 years after the Buddha. But I think it's a fallacy to say that therefore Mahayana is somewhat later than Theravada. Actually, they both have roots in what the Buddha taught, and they both develop those things in different ways. And if we want to look at things that are more authentic in early Buddhism and Mahayana, in Theravada Buddhism and Mahayana Buddhism, then we will be here all day. Okay, and I could list for you all of the different things that Theravada, like we wear robes that are more similar to what the Buddha taught than Mahayanas do, so we win that point. Yes. On the other hand, one vinaya detail, which I've noticed through the years, is that every Mahayana temple that I've ever been to has been spotlessly clean, which definitely is vinaya, and I've spoken about it quite some length in the vinaya, and not every Theravada temple that I've been to has been spotlessly clean, okay? So in that respect, Mahayanist win. Well done, okay? So this isn't about Theravada and Mahayana specifically. It's about early Buddhism and Theravada. Now, in much of the world, these things are regarded as synonymous, and especially if you're in or from East Asian cultures that practice Mahayana, like if you're in Korea or Taiwan and so on, then when they say early Buddhism, they usually just mean Theravada, right? It's the same thing, but that's not how I'm using it here. I'm making that differentiation that early Buddhism is what was taught around the time of the Buddha and for the few generations afterwards, as opposed to Theravada Buddhism. So Theravada, like every school of Buddhism, has accumulated a whole history and a whole bunch of ideas and so on and so forth. And as I mentioned earlier, that, you know, the point about understanding this is not to say that this is right and this is wrong. The point is to say to understand how things work in their historical context. If we look at what early Buddhism is, then we can see what the schools of Buddhism do as a response to that. How do you live the Dhamma in your time and place? And of course, people find all ways of doing that. And we can like this or dislike that or whatever. But it's not about saying that therefore this is right or this is wrong. It's about saying how can we live the Dhamma with more wisdom and authenticity. Because to me, whatever tradition that we're from, what matters is that that tradition is alive. And as soon as that tradition becomes a dead letter, something that's frozen and stuck in time, then it stops being actually the living Dhamma. That's to me is really the point. Okay. So over the years of studying these things, I've come across a whole bunch of things that are like different points of doctrine and practice and so on, where I've noticed that there's a difference between Theravada and early Buddhism. And I've noticed that a lot of the times practitioners don't really see these things or don't really notice them. And so I made this checklist so you can look it up and then see how these different people do it. It happens all the time, especially it happens when you're listening to teachers. People ask me these questions, oh, but so-and-so said this and so-and-so said that. And, you know, if you have some historical perspective, then you can understand why they're coming from those different places. Okay, so there is one great thing that both early Buddhism and Theravada have in common, and that is the fact that if they're going to be using their phones, they should make sure that they're charged up beforehand. So let's see how we go, because we're already on the red line here. So I wrote this list of checkpoints, okay, and many of them you might think are boring. Okay, fine, but I'm just going to mention a few of them as we go along that strike me right now. I'm not going to go into all of them. In fact, each one of these points could be a whole Dhamma talk, really. Probably should be. Okay, okay, first one. So, yes. Do I want a charger? How am I going? It's all right. If it dies, I'll just make it up. I wrote it. Okay. It's a battery pack. Look, I wrote it. I know what it says. So, okay. So first point: the two truths. Has anybody heard the doctrine of the two truths? You see, you've heard of it.
Sorry.
You've heard of it. A few people have heard of it. What are the two truths? Relative truth and ultimate truth. Anybody heard of relative truth and ultimate truth? Yes. Good. Excellent. So where did you hear about relative truth and ultimate truth from? Not from the suttas, that's for sure, okay?
I've purchased a book recently written by a Mahayana Buddhist author.
That's correct, yeah. It's very prominent in some schools of Mahayana as well. Of course, there are different ways of interpreting it and so on.
Exactly.
So if you've heard about that, you haven't heard about it from the suttas because the suttas doesn't talk about that, okay? Interesting, right? Fun. So what do we mean when we talk about the two truths? Well, it's fun to me. What do we mean when we talk about the two truths? So in Theravada, it's usually been explained as to say that in a relative sense that we talk about a person, right? But in the ultimate sense, it's not self, all right? So it's a way of helping us to understand, right? So there's persons, pugala in Pali, right? Individuals, right? So the word pugala is actually a specifically Buddhist word that was invented by the Buddha for this purpose, interestingly enough. So pugala is a person or an individual, but it's not a self, okay? So this is a kind of bit of a contradiction there, right? And obviously we have to manage that in our lives. You can't show up for, you know, your parking fine and say, no, I'm not going to pay this because that's for this person and I'm a Buddhist, so we don't have a self. So deal with that, Mr. Police Officer. So that's not how it works, right? We still have personal responsibility and so on, but the Buddha is saying that there's no self which exists. So that distinction helps us to understand the difference between talking in a conventional sense about a person and talking in an ultimate sense about a not-self. The problem with that is that, and the reason why the Buddha didn't make that kind of distinction, is that the idea of talking in some kind of sense of ultimate truth is very problematic philosophically, right? Because what happens is you then end up identifying your particular expression of the truth, like the words you use to describe the truth, become identified with that ultimate truth. And this is a kind of tendency which tends to happen as philosophies get reified, that is to say, as the living Dhamma becomes turned into a dogma. And so the ultimate truth becomes then another kind of level of dogma. In fact, the Buddha did use the word ultimate truth, but the only thing he called ultimate truth was Nibbana. There we go, got Nibbana in there. Excellent. And nibbana is ultimate truth because delusion has ended and ignorance has ended, right? Right. So there's nothing to grab hold of. There's nothing to get attached to. So we can talk about truth in different ways without necessarily saying that one of them is ultimate. So you think about, say, how a physicist talks, right? So a physicist will say atoms are mostly space and there's particles and energies which are moving and so on and so forth, but actually most things are empty space. And but a physicist does not therefore try to walk through a wall, right? Because they know that a wall exists and that these things. So this is similar to the idea of ultimate, what we would call ultimate truth and relative truth, right? So it's different ways of talking about things that are more accurate in context, right? A physicist doesn't say, I'm going to walk across the conglomeration of atoms in a lattice work framework of energies move, right? They say, I'm going to walk across the floor. And they understand that that's the thing. So we can talk about different contexts and different ways of just talking about things without invoking the idea of relative truth and ultimate truth. That makes sense? Okay. So this is kind of subtle philosophical difference. And I don't even want to say that that way of talking about things is wrong. If people are talking using that, it can be a useful way of framing things. Right, but it just has those connotations which can tend to lead you to sort of get attached to things in the wrong way. So another specific doctrine in Theravada is that the Buddha taught the Abhidhamma. Okay, so who knows what the Abhidhamma is? Maya.
I don't know anything about Abhidhamma.
Uh-huh.
Okay, but I believe Abhidhamma is a deeper understanding of the religion.
Okay.
That's what I think. I may be wrong.
Okay. Okay.
And I haven't studied Abhidhamma at all.
Okay.
But
okay.
I believe if you are Buddhist, just because you don't know Abhidhamma, I believe it's not such a big thing.
Okay. We're okay if we don't know Abhidhamma, I think. Okay. Very good. Thank you for that, Maya. So Abhidhamma is Abhidhamma really means about the Dhamma. Okay? And the Abhidhamma originally, Abhi is a prefix meaning something like metta. Like, so it's a metta discourse, discourse about the discourse, right? But it's often taken in the sense, like you just said, of like being a deeper Dhamma or a higher Dhamma, but that's not actually the original meaning of it. The original meaning of Abhidhamma is about the Dhamma. So the Buddha would teach the Dhamma, say the Four Noble Truths, and then afterwards some of the monastics would sit around and discuss about that teaching. Oh, what did the Buddha mean by dukkha? What did he mean by jati? And then have a discussion about that. And when those discussions are then systematized and gathered into various books, we call that the Abhidhamma and the Abhidhamma Pitaka, and then it creates one of the three branches of the Buddha scriptures, which then has a whole tradition behind it as well. So in Theravada, it's usually believed that the Buddha taught the Abhidhamma, but historical scholars are agreed that that is not the case. So the Buddha did not teach Abhidhamma. He taught the suttas, and the suttas were systematized through discussion and formed those books known as the Abhidhamma. And we know this for a whole bunch of reasons. This is actually not at all an interesting topic in historical Buddhist scholarship. Okay, this is like the theory of evolution or something like that. Like biologists don't get together and say, oh, is the theory of evolution really correct, right? It's just, it's a non-issue, right? We know that that's correct. So this is like that. Abhidhamma, it's so obvious that the Abhidhamma was later. In scholarship, it's not really a live issue, but it's usually taught as being taught by the Buddha and in some way of being kind of better than the suttas, like deeper or something like that. Okay, so that's another one. Let's go to another one. This one is particularly interesting to me, and it's a lot of my research, and it's about the loss of the Brahmanical context. So when the Buddha was talking, he taught a lot to people who were not Buddhists. In fact, if you look at things like the Digha Nikaya, the first of the Buddhist collections of suttas, most of those discourses, the Buddha is talking to people who weren't Buddhist, right? Interesting, right? it's interesting the amount of time that the Buddha spent discussing with non-Buddhists. Now, of course, this being India, there are all different kinds of people there, and all believers and non-believers and different religions and so on and so forth. But one of the main religious threads at the time was what we call Brahmanism or Vedism. Today we would call that Hinduism, but they didn't use that term in those days. And the Buddha is very frequently speaking to people from different Brahmanical backgrounds, having these kinds of discussions. And a lot of the times quite very interesting discussions, sometimes quite funny, sometimes quite revealing, and all of these things. But that situation changed very quickly, okay? After the Buddha died, within a very shortly, in fact, seems almost immediately, the Buddhist community had become so well established that the Buddhists mostly just spoke with among each other, that they didn't speak with, they weren't having those kinds of discussions with non-Buddhists in the same way. And that's still mostly true today. Mostly Buddhists speak with other Buddhists, speak about Buddhism with other Buddhists, and are not doing interfaith or discussions with people who are outside of Buddhism. And that happened fairly quickly. For example, we can see that the first discourse in the Buddhist canon, the Brahmajala Sutta, 62 kinds of wrong views, all of them discussions with various non-Buddhist views, theories and doctrines and so on. So the similar book in the Abhidhamma is the Katawattu, and that was a discussion of many different issues, all interpretations of Buddhist doctrines, right? So if the suttas discuss wrong views, they're non-Buddhist views. And the Abhidhamma discusses wrong views, they are different interpretations of Buddhist views. Yeah? And that shift happened very quickly, a few generations, maybe 100 years or even less. So because of that, that has many implications, but one of the implications is that the Buddhist communities lost sight of a lot of the things that the Buddha was actually talking about in the suttas because they didn't understand the context. And I come across this constantly in doing my historical research. I couldn't cite you just one or two examples. I could cite you hundreds of examples where there are things which you find in the suttas which the context has been just kind of lost in later years. I'll give you one fun example. This is not a particularly important example, but it's one that I like. It's a fun example. Okay. So this example is in the, which sutta is it? Asala? Oh, I have to remember the sutta. Anyway, the Buddha's discussing with some Brahmins about lineage and caste, okay? So the Brahmins are very proud of their caste, okay? And we're going to get reborn according to our caste and so on and so forth. And there's one line right at the end of it, which is very kind of odd. And the Buddha said, oh, not only would you, something like this, not only would you, is your doctrine not established, but even Purna Dharvi, what was it? Purna Dharvi Gaha would not agree with you. I can't remember the exact phrase, but it's something like that. And the commentary explains that as being Purna, the name Purna, who is the spoon holder. Okay, even Purna the spoon holder wouldn't agree with you. Something like that. Don't quote me on this. Okay, don't quote me. Okay, you can look at the footnotes for this. Okay, it's kind of an odd thing. Who's Purna? Why is he suddenly being mentioned here? Why? Purna's off to the side saying, why are you dragging me into this discussion? Okay, all right. So it's a kind of odd little moment in the suttas. So I go, but do some research. It turns out it's got nothing to do with a spoon holder called Purna or anything like that. It's got to do with a specific Vedic ritual which was done, which was mentioned in the Shatapada Brahmana before the Buddha, but which the Buddhist tradition obviously didn't know anything about, but which the Buddha did because he studied under Brahmanical teachers. And there's a specific detail about this ceremony. It's actually a very nice ceremony. It's done at the end of the rainy season and the beginning of the cold season. And what happens is you do all your ceremonies, offer the rice, blah, 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 and you leave at the bottom of the rice pot, you leave a little bit of rice just to be scraped at the bottom of the pot. You leave that to the next day, okay? Then the next day you scrape up the very last of that rice, okay, to make one full spoon of rice. This is the Purnadavi, is a full spoon. Yeah. And why? Because remember, this is the end of the hot season and the rainy season. We're about to go into the cold season. Nothing grows, crops are all dead, land is dead, everything. We just have that rice which is left at the bottom of the pot. And then we say over that spoon, a little verse, and the verse says, full spoon, fly away, come back to me even more filled. Yeah? It's nice, right? It's a cute little ceremony, right? We're saying we're going into the cold season, nothing's going to be growing, but come back to me next year and we'll be all even more filled. Huh? And so it's a little reference to that ritual which the Buddha was aware of, but which the Buddhist tradition lost sight of. Right? Understandably, right? Why would we learn that unless we're weirdo obsessives checking into detail like this? Right? And so when the Buddha was using that, it was about the reason why he talked about it was about like continuity and tradition, right? It's about, and it, he was saying that, anyway, look, there's a whole context to it which I won't go into, but that just gives you an example of one case where the Buddhist tradition has really lost sight of that thing. Now, in that particular case, it's not very important, right? That's not going to change anything. But there are other cases which I think are very important. For example, the idea that Nibbana is a kind of transcendent consciousness, which in my view is just a rehash of the Upanishadic idea of Brahma being an infinite consciousness. And yet in Buddhism, countless forms of Buddhism, we find this idea, which most people don't really realize is actually just taken from the Upanishads. Anyway, let me continue. Okay, next one, spirit of inquiry. Okay, so this is an interesting one. It's not a specific doctrinal thing, okay? But many of you here grew up in traditional Buddhist contexts, right? So you went to Buddhist Sunday school, right? Yes, some of you? Yes? No? Yes? No? And you do you go to Sunday school? No? You had a Buddhist education? Some of you? Yes, okay. So when you're in the room in that school, how many times did they ask you what you think? Rarely, right? Okay, so one of the most common phrases you find in the suttas, tankin manyata, what do you think? Yeah, the Buddha says this all the time. It's in the second discourse, anatthalakkhana sutta. What do you think, monks? Is form permanent or impermanent? Yeah, and so that way of engaging and question and having a conversation actually is highly characteristic of the suttas. Yeah, and yet in Theravada Buddhism has become very much a didactic. Right? I'm here, I'm the expert, and I'm here to tell you what is and what isn't. Okay, so that's not like a contradiction or something. But it definitely is something that's different. So you see, like the way that I teach here, like I try to engage people, try to wake you up occasionally, ask them questions, get people going, and hopefully people then remember more. That's kind of the idea, and to be able to think about things rather than just from me. All right. Let me continue I'll give a few more examples. Meditation retreats, that's another good one, right? Meditation retreats. So we just did one out in the desert, yeah? We're going to be doing another one later in the year. So it's not an early Buddhist practice, sorry to say. We picked it up from the Burmese, who invented it in the mid-20th century. The Burmese may have picked it up from the Zen people, I think, who were doing their sesshin, I think. But certainly we don't find the idea of a meditation retreat in early Buddhism. Okay. Now, that doesn't mean that lay people weren't meditating. It doesn't mean there weren't retreats. There were retreats. But the way the retreats were handled in the suttas is that when you were ready, you would go to the Buddha or to senior teacher and you would say, I want to go on retreat. And then the Buddha would either give you a meditation, you take it away on retreat, or in a few cases would say to you, what are you talking about? You haven't been paying attention to anything that I've said so far. What makes you think you're going to be having a time on retreat? right? So you went on the retreat when it was the right time for you to do that for your spiritual practice, right? Rather than we're having a big group, and it was an individual thing, rather than having a big group. So that idea of having a big group retreat is very much a modern innovation. And I feel kind of very much ambivalent about it. Like, obviously these things can be very beneficial, but also I think if we overemphasize them, then, you know, you can become a culture of doing retreats rather than a culture of spiritual cultivation. So for the early Buddhism, the practice for lay people, rather than going on retreats, was to take 8 precepts once a week, right? Take 8 precepts once a week. This is the Buddha, something very strongly recommended by the Buddha. So if you take 8 precepts once a week, that means that, you know, you can spend that day doing some practice, doing some devotions, reading some suttas. So you effectively get 1 day of retreat every week, which is 49 days of retreat, 52 days of 49 days. It's a lot. It's like 7 weeks,
52.
Thank you. Yes. That's because my brain is going. So 52 weeks. Thank you. So it's about 7 weeks. That's why I was thinking about that. Yeah. Of retreat. So you have about 7 weeks of retreat every year. Yeah? 7 weeks and 3 days. Thank you. We've sorted out the mathematics. So it's not to say that one is right or one is wrong, but it is to say that there's a difference in the emphasis. And of course, that's not necessarily a difference with Theravada. Actually, that is one practice that is often kept within Theravada Buddhism. Certainly when I grew up as a monk at Wat Nanachat in northeast Thailand, and that one day on the opposite day during retreat was the normal thing. Okay. All right, so let's go on a few others. Okay, so I know I'm racing through a bunch of different points here, but oh well, there we go. Okay, the Bodhisattva, right? So who is the Bodhisattva? So in Theravada, as in Mahayana, the Bodhisattva is somebody who is a being who has devoted themselves by making a vow in their past life, developing the perfections over many lifetimes to become a Buddha in this life. And if we search in a dictionary for Bodhisattva, then it will tell us that a Bodhisattva is somebody who set aside their own enlightenment in order to practice for the enlightenment of all beings, something like that. So those ideas we don't find in the early suttas at all, right? None of those ideas in the early suttas. We don't find the idea of making vows in past lives. We don't find the idea of developing perfections over many lives. And we don't find the idea of the Bodhisattva as somebody who's born in order to get enlightened. Or we don't find the idea that they set aside, that they practiced out of compassion for all sentient beings. So sorry to anybody for having their world shattered here. But I'm just conveying to you the fact. So the Buddha, the term Bodhisattva is originally used only for Siddhartha, when he has gone forth and is actually practicing for enlightenment, okay? And I believe that etymologically it should be bodhisattva, meaning one who is intent on enlightenment, rather than bodhisattva, an enlightened being. So I think the original uses of bodhisattva is specifically for that 6-year period when the bodhisattva is striving to practice for awakening. And in that whole period, he never says that he's practicing out of compassion for all sentient beings. Fun fact, yeah? He's practicing to escape from birth, aging, and death, yeah? And only afterwards, when he's become enlightened, does he then reflect, oh, maybe I could help others, and then turn around and start helping others. So, again, kind of interesting, right? And that's obviously major developments in Buddhist tradition, and we can follow those traditions through and look at the ways that the Buddha was envisaged in time and the doctrines of the Bodhisattva. But if you look at how the Bodhisattva doctrine evolved, it evolved little bit by little bit and piece by piece. So that kind of mature doctrine of the Bodhisattva that we think of today emerged a few hundred years after the Buddha. Okay. Moving on, a few other interesting ones. Okay. What about omniscience? Did the Buddha know everything? You don't think the Buddha knew everything?
Yes, what? He did.
You think he knew everything?
I tell you why I think it's because when he attained Nirvana, he was reawakened. He then remembered his true essence in tying up with the cosmos, or Brahmaloka, whatever you like to call it. And therefore, he was able to tap into all of the knowledge of infinity in his creation.
So when he became enlightened, he realized his relation to all things and then tapped into the infinite knowledge.
Yes.
Okay, so that is more or less, I mean, not necessarily exactly the same, but most of the Buddhist traditions would tell you something not dissimilar to that. But you'll be shocked to know, not in the suttas, okay? So in early Buddhism, the Buddha denied being omniscient. And he said he knew the Four Noble Truths and he knew a lot of things, but he didn't know everything. And, in fact, he kind of made fun of spiritual teachers who claimed to know everything. So they'll say, I know everything. And they walk into town, they get bitten by a dog. And they'll say, but I had to get bitten by a dog. That's why I walked there. So again, the Buddha obviously had access to kinds of knowledge which seem astonishing to us, but he did deny knowing everything. Okay, moving along. Part of that means also that he didn't claim the knowledge of prophecy. Okay, so the very common part of Buddhist traditions is that the Buddha said in such and such years this will happen, or such and such a time in the future this will happen, the sasana will come to an end, and so on and so forth. But we don't find that kind of prophecy in the early texts in early Buddhism. What the Buddha did say in early Buddhism was conditional statements. He would say, if this happens, then that will happen. If the Buddhist community practices properly and practices sila, samadhi, panya, and if they keep their respect for the Buddhist tradition and so on and so forth, then Buddhism will flourish. And when they stop doing those things, then Buddhism will fade away. So he does talk about the future, but he only talks about it in a conditional sense. All right. So again, this is a kind of a difference between early Buddhism and things. So the Buddha's travels, again, I do feel like I might just issue a sensitivity warning here for any Sri Lankans present. The next part could be distressing. The Buddha did not visit Sri Lanka, unfortunately. I know. Nor did he visit Thailand or China or Myanmar. He hung around in northern India in the Gangetic Valley. And there's no evidence that he ever travelled wider than that. Again, this is fairly strongly established by the prevalence of the text, the culture and the archaeology, and various other things as well. So sorry about that. Moving on, Buddha images. Okay, so do you think the Buddha was going around telling people, you know what's really great? Make an image of me, all right? Make a statue of me. I think you've got to make him look like really handsome. And no, that did not happen. So the Buddha image emerged, of course, after the Buddha died. Originally, in the early Buddhist community, the people, their focuses of devotion would be the Bodhi tree, probably the earliest one, the Bodhi leaf, the stupa, the Dhamma wheel, the Buddha's footprint, and the seat. So there was an empty seat, and you see this in a lot of the very earliest sculptures. And so these were all regarded as symbols for the Buddha. And then at some point, about 400 years after the Buddha passed away, then they started making Buddha images. And the story of the origination of the Buddha images is kind of an interesting one, but certainly wasn't a part of early Buddhism. Okay. Next one, relics. Again, probably a sensitivity warning required here. almost all of the things regarded as relics for the Buddha are not really relics of the Buddha. And the only things, okay, first of all, the Buddha didn't teach about relics, right? The worshipping relics was not part of the Buddha's teaching, okay? He taught about, and you'll be shocked to learn this, practicing the Eightfold Path, right? That was his main thing that he kept on going on, and worshipping relics was not, did not feature like it at all. Where did it come from? I think ultimately these things come from, look, if you want, one of the best illustrations of that, okay, if you look at the Mahaparinibbana Sutta, you look at paintings of the Mahaparinibbana when the Buddha passed away, yeah, and you'll always see that from Mahaparinibbana Sutta, it says, oh, those who were enlightened, then they reflected and said, oh, the Buddha passed away. How could it be otherwise because all things are impermanent? But then those things, people who are not enlightenment, they wept and they beat their breasts and they rolled around on the floor saying, too soon the eye of the world has been taken from us. And so there's always been these kind of two strands within Buddhism, right, that we have this ideal that we know all things are impermanent, but we also kind of, we don't want it to be. So there's this kind of ways of kind of almost like bringing the Buddha back, or at least feeling some kind of physical connection with him through images or through relics, and they give you something tangible, you know, rather than say something like an abstract teaching or something. So it creates like a physical connection. And so this is where I think that a lot of these things came from. So according to the tradition, after the Buddha died, his relics were divided up and taken to different places. And that probably happened, and there's probably stupas around the place that have those relics. And there's a couple of relics that seem to actually stem from that. The ones in the Delhi Museum seem to have the best provenance. Has been recovered from Kapilavastu. So if you are interested, if you're in Delhi, do check out the Delhi Museum. Delhi Museum is great anyway. But, yeah, there's the Buddhist relics there. So they seem to be actual Buddha relics, and interestingly enough, they're just old bones. They're not like crystalline or anything like that. They're just old bones from a urn. Anyway, so relics. So I could keep on going on a lot of different things here. The present moment is another one. How many times have we heard about the present moment? Right? Everyone talks about the present moment. Not in the suttas. Okay? There's no word for the present moment in the suttas. There's the present, but not the present moment. Okay? It's a subtle difference. Okay? So I learned about this from David Kalpahana. He said that the present moment was like walking on a tightrope, and the present was like riding on a camel. Right? You've got a bit of wiggle room in the present, you know? Yeah, it's not quite so tight. So another one which is actually very important, I've spoken about this a number of times, and I got asked about it quite a few times in Indonesia as well, is about deathbed karma. So these days it's very common, people are taught that your rebirth is determined by your last thought moment. I might make this the last time because I have to finish up. So people say that your rebirth is determined by your last thought moment, so you've got to be careful, otherwise you're screwed. Okay, this is the thing. And a lot of people take this very seriously and are very scared about it. A lot of people are very anxious about this whole thing. But this whole idea is so wrongly headed from so many different perspectives. Number one perspective is that rebirth is not determined by thought. Rebirth is determined by karma. The karma is an intentional and volitional action that has a moral weight to it. It doesn't just mean you have a random thought and then that's karma. That's not how karma works. Karma works because you decide to do something that's either good or bad, and that volitional choice you make then is a causative force that shapes your life after that. You decide to give something to somebody, then that's a volitional act, yeah? And if you decide to hurt somebody, it's a volitional act. These things are karma and they have a weight to them. Just a thought that comes and goes doesn't have any weight to it. So don't worry too much about that, okay? It's not karma. Karma is a choice. It's a decision. And the whole last thought moment thing really just stems from, again, from Abhidhamma and from the Abhidhamma analysis of what happens. But I think it's often, but I think it's been really taken in the wrong way in modern times. In fact, the Abhidhamma analysis is in terms of, and I'm not sure if I can get all of these exactly right, but at the time of your death, you can have the Achinna Kamma is the habitual Kamma, the Garaka Kamma is a heavy Kamma, and then the, I can't even remember the different categories now. Anyway, so there are different kinds of Kamma that can be operative at death. In almost all cases, okay, the karma that is going to shape your rebirth is the normal things that you've been doing for your whole life. Okay, we call achinna karma. It's a habitual, regular, ordinary, everyday karma. How you choose to live your life. You meditate every day, that's good. You try to be a kind person, that's good. You keep your precepts, that's good. All of these things create a force in your mind, and in the vast majority of cases, that's what's going to determine your rebirth. Okay, now in a few cases, some people will have an extraordinarily strong karma, they call Garuka karma, which might overwhelm even habitual karma, okay? So let's say that you're a good person, okay? You go around, you're kind to animals, you do the right thing. Okay, there was that one time you did a bit of light murder on the side, okay? But you can't, does that just define your whole life, okay? Well, in terms of karma, probably it is, okay? So karma is kind of relentless in that way. So if you've done something that's very strong like that, then it's likely to overwhelm all of those good things you've done. Doesn't mean those good things are worthless, right? They still will have their karmic fruit. But that really strong karma will usually determine your rebirth. Same thing happens for a very good karma. So, for example, maybe one time you're on a retreat and you get into jhana. Maybe that's the only time that you have a jhana in your whole life, right? Nonetheless, at the time of death, because that mind state is so powerful, then that is likely to determine your rebirth. You get reborn in the Brahma realm just because that power of that karma. The suttas actually talk about this, that no limited karma can remain within that space. So these are some examples of where you do a heavy karma that is going to overwhelm what your regular karma might be. The other kind of karma is what they call death proximate karma. And this is what people think. They think, oh, I'm going to die because of what's happened when I'm going to, but, you know, I'm going to, what my mind, my thought at that time of death is going to determine my rebirth. But that's not what death proximate karma means. Death proximate karma only pertains when you are actually doing some karma at the time when you die. Okay? So if you decide, for example, I'm going to get in my car, I'm going to drive to my ex's house and burn the house down with them inside, okay? And then you have a car accident on the way, then you die, then that is your karma, which is actually in your mind at the time. So there's really two examples of that which are given in the suttas. First example is of Dhananjani, who was a corrupt tax collector. Dhananjani did spend his whole life skimming the books and getting money that he shouldn't have. But at his deathbed, Venerable Sariputta came to see him and talk to him. And he felt remorse for everything that he'd done. He asked forgiveness for all his criminal activity. And he undertook precepts and undertook meditation on his deathbed. And so because he had a genuine deathbed conversion, right, then that created the karmic input that led him to have a good rebirth, okay? Again, it doesn't mean that all that bad karma disappears, but it means that at the time of death, it was that very positive shift in the mind which was a determining factor. On the other hand, there's a sutta that talks about a warrior who goes into battle, kill, 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 and their mind is just with thoughts of killing. And so when they die, then they will go to a bad destination because of the karma which is in their mind at that time, the karma to kill. But most of us, when we die, are not making much karma. Most of us are lying in a hospital bed, not really thinking very much at all. or doing very much. I mean, we might be, okay? We might be lying there in our deathbed planning vengeance against all our enemies, okay? Maybe I'm going to come back. I'm going to come back and haunt them in my next life. I'm going to come back and haunt them. That'll teach them. I'm going to, right? Maybe, right? But most people are not really doing that, okay? So most of the time, most of us don't actually die making that strong karma. So we don't have any death proximate karma. And so this was talked about in one sutta when the Buddha was talking with Mahanama, the Sakyan, who came to him. He said, well, sometimes I trip over and I think, what if I, and I lose my mindfulness and I'm falling. And what if I was to die in this moment? I've lost my mindfulness. Would I go to a bad destiny? And the Buddha said, Ma bhai Mahanama, Ma bhai Mahanama. Do not fear Mahanama. Do not fear Mahanama. How can it be that one like you, who has practiced the Dhamma for many years, has kept precepts for many years, how could it be that someone like you is going to be reborn in a bad realm? It's not possible. It cannot happen. Do not fear Mahanama. Do not fear Mahanama. So this is an example of an idea which has come up from originally from like a technical Abhidhamma analysis. The original point of it was to analyze what exactly is happening in the process of dying and getting reborn. So the questions that Abhidhamma is interested in, right? What wants to know actually what are the mental processes that are happening in that, and they analyze that through these details. So I don't think that that was the original purpose of it, but the way that it's been used in modern Theravada, it often induces that exactly that fear and that anxiety that the Buddha said the opposite of to Mahanama. And it is quite an anxiety. And honestly, I feel like it's a really inappropriate and quite, I think it's quite sad that people come along to Buddhism and then they hear these things and that they do get anxious and upset about it because of that. So this is an example of where that teaching has turned into something which is almost the opposite of what the Buddha said, really. Okay. Moving along, there's just a couple of points here in the online questions, which I'll just take briefly. So Dihayupa also confirmed, she said in Thailand, it says you go to the temple and you meditate. What's the point if you're still an angry person? Good point, actually. Tina in Singapore says, right view, how do I know my views are right according to the Dhamma? Oh, my goodness. Tina. Do not fear. We keep questioning and asking questions. Yeah. So Venerable Prasanna, thank you very much, has posted the link to the checklist. But Scott, how's it going, Scott? It's the name of my recent novel mentioned last week. That's called The Harbingers. My novel is called The Harbingers. Check it out. Ah, the set of books. So you're talking about the printing project. Maybe Venerable Prasanna, if you could put a link there to the printing project, that would be good. You've already done that. I'm sorry. Okay. Apologies for my lack of faith. Uno Dabigabo Majima 33. Okay. Somebody puts here, Neelakshi writes, what? He never visited Sri Lanka? I'm so sorry, Neelakshi. I am so sorry. Okay? Missionary people. Did the Buddha go to Indonesia? Sure.
While this isn't a fact, and I'm going to the Mahayana scriptures now. There is the Lankavatara Sutra, which is written by Zen masters. And it's basically discussing the relationship with the Ramayana Hindu epic.
Right, yeah.
How he goes to Lanka.
That's right, So the Lankavatara Sutra talks about how the Buddha, basically the descent to Sri Lanka is what the title means. And that's from like 2nd century CE, so it's roughly contemporary with the Ramayana as well. Yeah, so both of those relate to that. So that's kind of an extension of the cultural sphere at the time. So the cultural sphere in the time of the Buddha was basically the Gangetic Valley. Obviously, there were people elsewhere, but it wasn't part of the same culture, the same language, the same trade routes and so on. Sorry? That's correct, yeah. So that's the Lanka Vatara Sutta, yeah. No, the Theravadas believe it as well. You got Sri Lanka. Not early Buddhism, yeah. And but the Thais believe that the Buddha came to Thailand as well. Yeah, of course. Everyone thinks the Buddha came there. We could make up our own story about the Buddha coming to Australia. He would have gone to Uluru. If he can't, he'd go to Uluru, surely. So, oh, that's another one. Yeah, that's also in the list there. Yes, so in the suttas, it talks about samadhi. It's a state of consciousness that we reach through meditation. And in the commentaries, they also talk about kanika samadhi, is momentary or short-term concentration, and upachara samadhi, which is like threshold or neighborhood concentration. So these ideas also not found in the suttas. Yeah. Yeah. It's on the sort of central forum. Yeah, so how Buddhism differs from Theravada. Yep, you'll find it there if you just Google. That's how I found it today. Also not found in suttas, yeah. Go on, yes, please. I mean, Buddhism arrived in Sri Lanka, a couple of hundred years after the Buddha, roughly. It was around 200 to 300 years after the Buddha that the first split in the Buddhist schools happened, and that was between what scholars would refer to as the Stavira school and the Mahasanghika school. The Mahasanghika school no longer exists. But Stavira school evolved into different forms, one of which was the group that ended up in Sri Lanka. So when I'm doing historical studies, I'll refer to the Sri Lankan community as the Mahavihara school because it's based in Mahavihara at Anuradhapura, later by Giri and Jayatawana as well, so they had their own distinctive schools. So it kind of evolved gradually, right? I mean, even if you look at Sri Lanka, just one simple case, right? The oldest established by Reverend Mahinda, and then that was established through the Mahavihara, and that was the first one, then the Upayagiri, and then the Jayatawana, so the three schools in Sri Lanka. And in about 1200 AD, King Parakamabahu the First said, due to all of the endless squabbling between the monks, we haven't been able to unify the Sangha in Sri Lanka, but I basically made a law that said you all have to get along together, so now we only have one school in Sri Lanka. And so that's why in Sri Lanka there's only one school, because the king said so. And so even in Sri Lanka, it's a complex situation. And as you know, there's a lot of Mahayana in Sri Lanka, always has been. There's a lot of bodhisattvas and a lot of all of these kinds of things going back a long time. So it's certainly not the case that even if we consider Sri Lanka relatively, self-contained culturally, was still actually complex and had different forms of Buddhism and so on in there. So the same thing, of course, even more so in India. Yeah. Okay, Nilushi, one more question, then we will have to go. Okay, thank you. Excellent. Anya, you're welcome to join for dinner if you want. Okay. Thanks. We'll have to wrap up. Thanks, everybody, for your attention. Anyway, if that's interesting, use it. That thing was meant as a checklist, right? So you can just sort of skim it and check and so on. But if that's of interest, then hopefully that's there. Anyway, also, if anybody's interested, I did write a response to the Pope's encyclical on AI, which is also online. So please check that out. You can find that on my Blue Sky or on Discourse. So if you're interested, some of my favorite things, as you know, ancient Catholic patriarchies and AI. I don't know about favorite as such. That's probably not the right word to use, but there certainly are things And anyway, so I wrote a fairly long response to that. If you're interested, I do believe that it was deserving of a serious response. Anything else? It's happening Tuesdays at 5 in Parramatta. Come along and join. That's at the 5 Parramatta Square at 6 p.m. Venerable Tenzin's one-day retreat on the 4th of July through the Metta Centre.
Yeah.
Okay.
So deep ecology.
So contact Simo if you're interested in that. Yeah. Santi Sunday. Oh, that's at Western Sydney University. So Santi is having an afternoon event at Western Sydney Uni in Parramatta. So please check the Santi website for details about that if you want to join. Santi's doing a one-day retreat. So at Santi Monastery, one-day retreat tomorrow as well. Okay. So thanks very much, Venerable Prasanna, for posting those links on there. That's really appreciated. Okay. Okay, thanks, everybody. See you next week.
Done.